Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. And this is On Point. Desert canyons and crested buttes, mountains, pristine waterways. Some 10 million acres have what's called national monument status, which means they're protected by the federal government. But President Trump put those lands under review with an executive order he signed on April 26th. Now there are concerns the protections will be rolled back or even rescinded. This hour, On Point, the future of our national monument lands and waters. You can join us on air or online. Can you imagine uranium mines in the middle of Bear's Ears in southeastern Utah? What about gas exploration in Wyoming's Fossil Butte National Monument? Or maybe these treasured lands are better off under local control. What do you think? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. You know, we're at On Point Radio. And joining us now from Washington is Dan Hartinger, the National Monuments Campaign Manager for the Wilderness Society. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Tom.
And also in Washington is Rebecca Lieber. She's a reporter for Mother Jones, where she covers climate, energy, and the environment. Welcome to you, Rebecca.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having us on.
So, Dan, I have to say, when I first heard a reference to national monuments, I imagine many other people, think of the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, etc. I didn't think about land. Tell us, give us a quick review summary of what this means, national monument lands and waters.
Yeah, most people think the same thing, and I'd wager that the majority of Americans have never heard of the Antiquities Act, which is the law that allows a president to designate a national monument to protect places that are important to our culture, that have historic and scientific wonders that we want preserved for future generations. A national monument is really just a protected status of public lands that the American people own that has been designated to protect important historic and scientific objects, everything from the Grand Canyon to the Statue of Liberty to Cascade Siskiyou in Oregon, which protects an incredible ecosystem and biodiverse region that's important for a whole host of flora and fauna. So it's really a wide variety of things, everything from the historic places that tell the story of who we are as Americans, like the Birmingham Civil Rights National Monument, to iconic natural wonders like the Grand Canyon.
And what's the difference between, I mean, like Grand Canyon could be a national park, right? Or Glacier National Park or Yellowstone. What's the difference? Why is the Grand Canyon a national monument as opposed to a national park? And what's the difference?
Well, a national monument can be established by a president through proclamation. Since the Antiquities Act was signed into law in 1906 by President Theodore Roosevelt, 16 presidents, 8 Democrats and 8 Republicans have used it to establish over 150 national monuments. And nearly half of all national parks, including the Grand Canyon, were first protected as national monuments by forward-thinking presidents like Roosevelt. So a national monument protection is similar in some ways to a national park protection, but the designation actually is a little bit more flexible in that many of them can be managed by other federal land management agencies like the Forest Service and can allow things like hunting, grazing, fishing, climbing, and other recreational uses that are a little bit more constrained in our national park system.
And who makes those decisions of what's allowed?
So those decisions are made after designation. The federal land management agencies go through what's called a monument management planning process, and that's led at the local level by federal land managers based in those regions who solicit public input and work with local stakeholders to determine both the best way to protect the objects of a national monument proclamation, things like historic ruins or rock art or endangered species, while also allowing for continued access and recreation.
And Rebecca Lieber, let's bring us up to date, please, on what's happened just in the last few years. First, with what President Obama did, especially toward the end of his term in office, and then what President Trump is now doing.
President Obama declared millions of acres as monuments, particularly towards the end of his administration. So that's included both land monuments and marine monuments, which have been even larger than the ones that we saw declared just at the end of the year.
Marine monuments, meaning actually water that has monument status.
Yes, there were several in the Pacific Ocean that Obama declared towards the end of his second term. So Obama set aside these lands towards the end of his administration, and particularly after the election, he made the announcement on Bears Ears and a handful of other monuments and these have been controversial for years, and there was a big campaign to have these declared as monuments. So this certainly set off Republicans who were unhappy that Obama was using his last few months in office to do this.
And why did he wait until the very end of his term to do this?
Well, I don't know exactly what was going on in his head, but these certainly had some contested arguments, both for and against. There is a debate that I'm sure we will get into by Utah, where there is a debate over local control versus federal control of these lands. And you see that generally for presidents, and not just Obama, that they will declare national monuments towards the end of their time in office to cement their legacy. So we saw that for Bill Clinton, Bush, and many others as well.
Okay. And now President Trump takes office, and what does he do?
Well, Trump has said from the start that he wants to open up more lands for fossil fuel development. And this is part of this wider effort that we've seen both at Interior and EPA and across his government. So he has issued this executive order directing the Department of Interior to review monument declarations made by Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And he is kickstarting a rather unprecedented process to potentially roll back these monuments.
Right. And let's hear what he had to say in justifying that order that he signed on April 26th that would allow national monument designations to be rescinded or reduced in size, as Rebecca just explained, as his administration pushes to open up more federal land to drilling, mining, and other development.
The Antiquities Act does not give the federal government unlimited power to lock up millions of acres of land and water, and it's time we ended this abusive practice.
And meanwhile, a lot of the work in figuring out how to proceed on this will fall to Ryan Zinke, President Trump's Secretary of the Interior. His department is going to be making recommendations to the White House. He did a tour through Utah's Bears Ears National Monument in the beginning of May, and he says that these recommendations, when they come out, will be fair to everyone.
I'm actually optimistic. At the end of the day, we'll make a recommendation that I think will be best for our country and best for preservation.
But as Rebecca and Dan have said, this is controversial. In an interview with PBS from February, William Anderson, the former chairman of the Moapa Band of Paiute Indians, which considers Nevada's Gold Butte to be sacred land, said that Gold Butte's national monument status helps preserve its cultural legacy.
Now that it's a national monument, we're able to go ahead and show them how important it is to our people and to go ahead and see what else we could do to provide more funding.
Okay, and that was William Anderson, the former chairman of the Moapa Band of Paiute Indians in Nevada. Dan Hartinger, give us a little lineup of the players on both sides here. How important are these Native American groups to your campaign to preserve national monuments?
Well, I'd first like to clarify that it's not our campaign. It's really been led by the Native American tribes, particularly at Bears Ears. Before the monument was designated, a historic coalition of five sovereign tribal nations came together, which is the first time that these tribes have ever joined together to seek protection of their sacred and ancestral lands at Bears Ears. The Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, composed of the Navajo, Ute Tribe, Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, Hopi, and Zuni, put forth a proposal to seek protection of sacred sites, cultural cultural sites and the whole the sacredness of the Bears Ears landscape. And unfortunately, it really wasn't listened to or respected by the Utah delegation. So that's when they turned to President Obama and sought protection as a national monument, along with tribal governments, which are sovereign nations. You also have conservationists, historic preservationists, hunters, anglers, climbers, outdoor recreation industry, local businesses and communities that rely on these monuments to generate tourism and provide quality of life. And really, you know, 90% of the American public, poll after poll, shows that the American people overwhelmingly support protecting our public lands and waters. And then on the other side, you have, you know, a pretty narrow special interest, the oil and gas industry, uranium mining, and a few others who would like to see these protections stripped so that they can open them up to development. But of course, that risks damaging the very objects that these monuments are designed to protect.
Well, Rebecca, in doing your own reporting on this, is it just, as Dan says, the sort of the narrow economic interests that are favoring this reform, they might call it? Or did you find local groups that feel that way as well?
That so local groups, I'm sorry, I didn't quite
Those who are advocating some change in national monument status, is it limited to economic interests, or are there local groups, including Native American groups, that feel that local control is better?
Well, you would hear some Republican politicians in Congress say that, but the support for the monuments has been pretty vocal. We've seen that in public comments on the Interior's review. The Trump administration has put forward a public comment period, and there's been overwhelming support.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about President Trump's April executive order to review the status of national monuments. You can join our conversation. Will this impact you? We're talking with Rebecca Lieber. She's a reporter for Mother Jones, and Dan Hartinger, the National Monuments Campaign Manager for the Wilderness Society. But joining us now from West Jordan, Utah, is Ken Ivory. He's a Republican state representative there. He supports President Trump's executive order. He's also founder of the American Lands Council, which is front and center in the push to roll back the protections of the national monuments. Ken Ivory, welcome to On Point Radio.
Hello, Tom.
So, Ken, lay out, we've heard the concerns on the other side. Lay out the argument for why these the national monument status for these lands should be reconsidered.
Well, the argument is quite simple. If we believe in the promise and the principle of America, that the genius of America is protecting people in their life, their liberty, their property, their ability to govern themselves and determine their own destiny, and that's what gives us peace and prosperity, the most ingenious formula ever devised in the history of the world, if we believe in that, well, then what's happening is anathema to that. Within the 1.35 million acre monument designation that had no support from the state legislature, no support from the congressional delegation.
You're talking just about the Bears Ears, territory, right?
The Bears Ears, correct. Yeah. I mean, we can talk about the Grand Staircase, which was another million-acre land that was locked up. But when you look at just in Bears Ears, Tom, there was 110,000 acres of school children land that was locked up and seized. There was 14,000 acres of private lands that was seized with the stroke of a pen. Well, that's a complete abrogation of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution in takings. But to personalize it, let's go to the Grand Staircase Escalante Monument for a second. That was designated in 1996 by President Clinton. There was no NEPA analysis, National Environmental Policy Act. In fact, his advisors at the time said that it really would violate the law to do this without the kind of analysis that would go through this. But 20 years on, the mining industry, the grazing industry, the timber industry that was the mainstay of Garfield County is now gone. The county commissioners will tell you their number one export is their children. And in fact, a year and a half ago, the school district came to the county seeking a declaration of a state of economic emergency because the school children, the families are leaving, they can't support and sustain themselves any longer, and the schools are at risk of closing. They've gone from 150 K-12 students down to 50, and if they lose their schools, then no one wants to live in the counties. And you see counties over and over throughout the West where these vast, sweeping designations that take away their ability to care for their own lands and livelihoods, they'll tell you over and over, I hear it again and again, that the number one export in their communities are their children, the very children that they want to have enjoy the life and the lifestyle, enjoy the land, care for the land, prosper from the land, have access to the land, is being deprived by these sweeping pronouncements with no input. And
okay, so, Ken, you're making it
fundamentally to do we believe the promise of America?
You're raising a really important point here, and I want you to make it really clearly. Explain the linkage between the fate of schooling in these lands, the quality of the school system, and the issue of whether they should be under national monument status. What's the connection there?
Right. Well, in Utah, for example, nearly 70% of the land in Utah is controlled by the federal government. Well, schools east of the Rockies are funded by property tax. In the West, we're deprived of the ability to generate funding for schools, and so we're reliant on the type of industry that we can develop, and we're reliant on the whims and the pendulum swings coming from Washington. We have the lowest per pupil funding per capita in the nation in Utah because we have such tremendous control of the federal lands. So the ability to fund is deprived, and then the industries that were developed off of the land that were deprived from the monument designations, all of the living wage jobs that fund the counties have gone away. In fact, we did a legislative tour of Garfield County. That was ground zero for the Escalante Monument. Just a couple of weeks ago, the whole legislature went down. And the county commissioners told us this, Tom. They said they can generate enough property tax in Garfield County to run their county for 16 days.
So
rest of the time they have their hand out because there's only 3% taxable land in Garfield County.
So there's no property tax base to fund the schools is what you're saying.
Correct.
So let's broaden this discussion a little bit. We're talking here about national monuments. What about national parks? And do you you have two very famous, at least two very famous national parks there in Utah, Bryce and Zion, that are familiar to people all over the country. Do you want them, those lands, to be turned over to the state as well?
No, as a matter of fact, we have five wonderful national parks. We invite the world to visit them. And in everything that we've done, Tom, national parks, congressionally designated wilderness, congressionally designated monuments, off the table. We're not talking about those. When we have input, when we have the ability to have say in how we protect things, no, that's off the table. In fact, Tom, I believe we're still the only state in the union that has a state wilderness act. And so as we have greater control over the land, we've already identified areas within this area of the Bears Ears and others that would be state wilderness. We understand there are beautiful lands deserving heightened protection. I would add that in 2013, unfortunately, in the type of pendulum swinging and political footballs that happened in Washington, our national parks were arbitrarily shut down, and people that had had their life savings, their life journey coming to the national parks were turned away, and it was the state legislature that met in emergency session, appropriated $2 million to open the national parks, which, by the way, we've still not been paid back, the millions of dollars we put up to open the national parks. But this is what we see coming from thousands of miles away, where our lands and lives and livelihoods are treated as political footballs for political gamesmanship, and it really it just violates that very notion of self-governance and allowing people to pursue happiness. that was the foundation of our nation.
Well, here's the reason I bring up the national parks, Ken, because the very concept of a national park is that the land there belongs to the country as a whole. One of our listeners tweeted this, Holly. She said, the reason for national parks is to protect for people in every state. She's concerned that states will exploit resources and destroying them. Do you have any quarrel with this idea that certain areas of the country now in national parks really do belong to the country as a whole and not to the states where they happen to be located?
Well, yeah, there's a distinction, right? When you're talking national parks, that makes up about 10% of the state of Utah. It's still a greater percentage than any other state, but that makes up about 10%. And to be clear, we're not talking about that. We understand there are areas like that. Now,
but you do agree that certain territories belong to the country as a whole.
Right. When you've had the state legislature, if you go constitutionally, when you have the consent of the state legislature that has jurisdiction over the land within the states, there are areas that the state cedes control and jurisdiction over to the national government. We've done that with the national parks. But if you go back to this idea that everything belongs to everyone, Tom, at one point the state of Illinois was 95% federally controlled for decades. Michigan, Iowa, Louisiana, you know, that great western state of Florida, it was nearly 90% federally controlled for decades. And they rallied together, banded together, and compelled politically Congress to honor the statehood terms and transfer control of the land and resources and their livelihood to those states. And Tom, our statehood terms are exactly the same as those states east of the Rockies. So to be clear, there's two different areas of land that we talk about. There's treasured lands that we agree in Utah. There are many lands that deserve heightened protection, some national, others within the state. But then there's a vast amount of rangeland and forest land that is being mismanaged. The ecosystems are being destroyed. The forests are being destroyed. The industry and access is being destroyed and devastated. The watersheds are being destroyed because there's simply one size fits all does not work for the unique landscapes and the unique gardens, if you will, throughout the western United States.
Okay, Ken, I'm glad that you're willing to be on this program. I have to tell you that the calls that we're getting, and this probably doesn't come as a surprise to you, a lot of support here for national monuments, national parks, and I want you to be able to respond to some of these callers. First of all, let's go to Mark, who's on the line from Augusta, Georgia. Mark, you're on point.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
My concern is, you know, you talked about Roosevelt earlier and setting aside places, and I hear what Sim was talking about. I understand what you're saying, but my concern is that as time goes on, it seems like we're having this recession when it comes to our wild places where people can go. They're truly wild, that have places where people can go to get away from the noise, to get away from the lights, to get away from all the different sounds of leaf borers and cars. And I fear that as time goes on with the erosion of this act or what have you and what our administration is pushing for, we will see less and less of that. People need a place to go. We need to leave a legacy for our children and our grandchildren. And I fear very strongly that there won't be much left. There'll be plenty of shopping centers, plenty of places that bring economic growth, but not a lot for the inside and the spirit.
Ken Ivory, respond to that. His concern, which I'm sure is shared by many, that somehow removing the protections from these lands will put them in jeopardy.
Yeah, I wonder if the caller's ever been to Utah.
He's not on the line anymore. We had to make room for somebody else.
The landscape is so vast, Tom. I mean, it would take you 8 to 10 hours to drive from one end of the state to the other. And right now, 90% of our 3 million people live on 1% of the land in the state of Utah. So to think that every square inch of the land would somehow be exploited, be developed, really defies common sense. But to deny the opportunity for those who know the land best to care for the access, the health, and the productivity of the lands, again, abrogates the American promise. So if we believe in feudalism, where the few should control the pursuit of happiness for those west of them, and that's been a story that's repeated. I mean, it was Great Britain that controlled the colonies, and they broke off. And then when the United States was established, they controlled the lands of the West. They called them the Western Wastelands of Illinois and Missouri and Florida and Louisiana, and they had to fight the same fight. Well, then, both politically and from the very nature of control dynamics, the same thing's happening here. And so do we believe in self-governance? Do we believe in people caring for their own lands? Do we believe in states determining their own destiny, or do we not? That really is the fundamental question.
And that's Ken Ivory. He's a state representative in Utah and the founder of the American Lands Council. I'm Tom Jelton. This is On Point. And Ken, I want to just read, one of our callers wants to make this point, and rather than go to her, I'm just going to summarize it for you. She's concerned that if the states have the power over these lands and they're strapped for cash, they're going to make decisions in their economic interest, not in the interest of the country as a whole. And certainly there are a lot of states, and Utah, you've made that clear, Utah is certainly one of them, who have economic concerns, and there might be a temptation to exploit some of these lands for economic development.
Yeah, first of all, let me correct you. I was not the founder of the American Lands Council. There was a number of county commissioners and businesses and organizations who created it. They hired me to be the first president to go out and teach.
Okay, there you go.
No longer affiliated with that organization. But to your point, there are a number of studies out. I think one of the most comprehensive, the Property and Environmental Research Service, Research Center, excuse me, did a detailed analysis of the economics. The federal government loses 27 cents for every dollar it spends on public lands. States already control millions of acres of public land, and states, on average, generate nearly $15 positive net revenue for the acres. So clearly we can't afford to manage it the way the federal government does, and you all in the East are spending billions of dollars for the federal government to mismanage Western lands, when states that manage their own public lands generate positive net revenue, have equal or better environmental quality, better access, better recreation amenities, better hunting and fishing opportunities. So that really is a misnomer.
Okay.
But again, it goes back to who decides in our system of government.
Okay. Rebecca Lieber, I want you to respond to something that Ken Ivory said, which is that his concern is that in a lot of cases, these federally protected lands are not all that well maintained by the federal government.
Well, the thing that I think is a misunderstanding about national monuments is there's a wide range of agencies within the interior that are managing them, and they still have a lot of different kinds of activity. One thing that National Monuments prevents is new leases for mineral rights and mining and fossil fuel development. But they still are honoring on Grand Staircase, for example, existing fossil fuel leases. And everything from BLM to National Parks Service are helping in managing these lands. So I think it's a misunderstanding that you have a one-size-fits-all approach for these national monuments. It's quite varied.
And Dan Hartinger, I know that Ken Ivory has, and others have said, for example, that there's not enough attention to the quality of the forests, and as a result, you get wildfires sometimes on these lands.
You know, I think it's really important to point out that many of the same politicians in Congress who rail against the federal government are the ones who are responsible for funding the very land management agencies that they claim don't adequately manage the lands. It's very much circular logic to consistently underfund the land management agencies and then complain that they can't manage them properly to justify eventually giving them to the states and private industry.
Okay. And Rebecca Lieber, I know that you have to leave. Reporter for Mother Jones, a quick thought from you about what's at stake here.
This isn't necessarily just these national monuments at stake. There's a lot more that could happen in terms of Trump rolling back public lands protections. So we are talking about a much bigger issue than a handful of monuments in Utah. This is national lands at stake, essentially.
And this is Rebecca Lieber, reporter for Mother Jones. Thanks so much for joining us, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me on.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about President Trump's order to review national monument protections. You can join our conversations. How do you think national monument status affects local economies? Positive, negative? Of course, you can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And our guests are Dan Hartinger, the National Monuments Campaign Manager for the Wilderness Society, and Utah State Representative Ken Ivory. He was formerly President of the American Lands Council. And joining us now from Patton, Maine, is Lindsay Downing. She's the owner of Mount Chase Lodge, just outside the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. She is an On Point listener who pitched us the idea of focusing on this topic through the Harkin module at the On Point Listens page of our website. It's part of our 2017 National Listening Tour. And Lindsay, thanks for getting in touch with us on that. It was a good story idea you had.
Thank you very much.
So tell us your situation. Tell us about your lodge and how you feel that your business would be affected by this decision in the future of national monument status for Katahdin Woods and Waters.
Yeah, so Mount Chase Lodge is a small family-owned lodge located about 16 miles from the northern entrance of the designated Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. It has been in business for the past 40 years. Since the designation, my husband and I came up here to take over the family business. We've been running this lodge for just over a year now. And one of the major factors that sort of pushed us and gave us the final push to get up here was the fact that we knew that a national monument would draw significant attention to the region. And since the designation, it was designated in August, and since the designation, our visitation at our business has increased significantly, and not just here, but in the entire region. There's been a lot of focus on the region as a whole. So everything from Millinocket, Medway, East Millinocket, up here to Patton, Mount Chase, this whole region is getting a lot of new publicity and new hope in terms of how we can move on with this decision.
Well, Lindsay, I'm sure that the protection of the Katahdin Woods and Waters is very popular with backpackers and canoeists. What about the broader economy? There are, I'm sure, a lot of local people there who aren't themselves backpackers or canoeists. How do they feel about at stake?
So to give a little bit more background to our region, the wood products industry has kind of been our economic driver for many, many years. We have had recently, two, maybe three major mill closures within the Katahdin region, and those mills closing down really drove out the last bit of any industry that we had up here. And that's not to say that the wood products industry doesn't still exist, because it does, but we don't have these big mills anymore that are acting as the major employers in the area. And so the significant employers in our area now are the small businesses. They're the local grocery stores, the local lodges and resorts, the hardware stores. They're all family-owned businesses that are employing people. And to be quite honest, there's a large business community here that is very much in favor of the designation of Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument, because they understand that we need to have travelers, we need to have people come here to experience what we have. We have some of the world's greatest wilderness that's untouched.
Lindsay, I used to live in Maine, and I know the Katahdin area is very beautiful, and I'm sure a lot of Mainers are very proud of it. And we actually have on the line now Senator Angus King, is an independent senator from Maine. Senator King, thanks for calling in.
Tom, how are you? You used to live at North Haven Island, man. I know where you are.
Yeah, I sure did. Thanks very much. And I used to go up to Katahdin. So you've been listening to this conversation. And Senator King, I know that you are very familiar with the Katahdin area and this issue. What are your thoughts about whether the Katahdin Woods and Waters area and other areas around the country deserve national monument status?
Well, I can't speak to other areas, but I can tell you that in this case, it's given life and optimism and hope and an economic shot in the arm to a region that was really hurting. When this idea was first broached something like 20 years ago, I was governor, and I was opposed to it.
You were opposed to national monument status?
Well, I was opposed not to the monument necessarily, but to the idea of a park or you know, that kind of thing. But two things changed, Tom. One is the size of the project changed. It was originally they were talking about several million acres. Now we're talking about less than 100,000 acres. And secondly, as Leslie mentioned, the forest products industry, the huge paper mills in Millinocket and East Millinocket are now gone. And what we need is a variety, a diversity in our economy. And we've already seen positive economic results from this designation, even though it just took place last August. And this was a very contentious issue in the area. And I went up, met with local officials. I brought up John Jarvis, the head of the Park Service, had a full day with local officials. I think 1,400 people came to a public meeting. Everybody had their say. There's still people who are opposed. But my sense is that many people in the region are saying, okay, the decision's been made. Let's move on and see what positive can come from this. I see it as a net benefit to the region with virtually no downside.
Well, Senator King, I know you don't want to talk about other areas and you want to talk about Maine, which is what you should be doing as a senator from Maine. But there is a kind of a national issue here at stake, and that is on this question of who benefits economically. Are you convinced that the economic benefits that flow from designating areas as national monuments are enough to counteract the loss of jobs that will come from taking these areas sort of out of reach of developers, mining companies, timber companies, et cetera?
Well, I think it's very important to remember that a national monument can only be created on property that's already owned by the federal government. Every now and then, I got an email from a friend in Congress that talked about stop the federal land grab. This is already federal land. Now, the monument in Maine was donated to the federal government for the purpose of this use, but it's not like the federal government is coming in and taking land from somebody or setting it aside. And obviously, you have to look at each individual case. But particularly in rural areas, I was at a committee hearing yesterday of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee with a fellow going to the Department of the Interior who grew up in a very small town in Colorado. Turns out, he grew up near a national monument. I said, was it important economically to your region? He said, absolutely. So I don't think it's an either or. And if this property in Maine weren't a national monument, it would still be privately owned. And the owners, if they chose, could say no logging or no activity. This is going to create activity. And uniquely to Maine, it allows snowmobiling and hunting on part of the property. It's an incredibly beautiful piece of land. It's sort of a microcosm of northern Maine. It has the east branch of the Penobscot and great views of Mount Katahdin, hills, trails. I sound like the Chamber of Commerce, but it's a great piece of property, and I think the benefits are going to significantly outweigh any cost. In fact, I can't identify any cost. Okay. Originally, people were worried it would somehow preclude forest products development, but I've really dug into the legal side. I don't think that's the case.
Well, I know there is no dispute about the beauty of that area. Senator Angus King, he joined us from Gorham, Maine. Senator King, thanks so much for calling in. You have some valuable thoughts.
thank you, Tom, and thanks for talking about this important topic.
All right. Let's go back now to Lindsey Downing. We sort of cut you off there, Lindsey, because we wanted Senator King to weigh in on this. You've been to Washington to lobby for this case. Are you involved sort of on the national debate about the future of national monuments as a result of what you've seen there in Maine?
No, I mean, I support national parks and monuments for sure. I am not necessarily involved in anything that's going on elsewhere in the country. I do know of other business owners and other Chamber of Commerce members out west who are fighting the same fight. But you know, I went to Washington with the specific goal of bringing our situation to light and making sure that our congressmen and senators knew the benefits that were happening up here. Because there's so much media, you never know exactly what's actually going on, but we're living here and we're running a business here, and I wanted to make sure that they knew exactly what was going on in our neck of the woods.
Ken Ivory there in Utah, before you go, I want you to have an opportunity to respond to the arguments that Lindsey is making and also that we heard from Senator King, which is that you can't underestimate the economic benefits that national monument status can bring to a local community in terms of the increased tourist traffic, the commerce, et cetera.
Well, think of what, and thank you for the opportunity to respond. Think of what Senator King said. Diversity, the opportunity to diversify. Maine has a total of 1 million acres of public land in the whole state. We've had two national monuments in the last 20 years that were both in excess of 1 million acres each. We have over 70% of our land that is publicly controlled. In Garfield County, where the Escalante Monument was, they have 97% public land. And so we have studies. There's a number of studies out there that, to a point, yes, there's a benefit. You know, when you're at 20-25% public land in a county, there can be a very definite benefit. But then, like anything, too much of anything can be not a good thing. You get the diminishing returns. And, you know, when you're 75, 80, 90% public land, let me tell you about a family business, to go to Lindsey's point. Ruby's Inn is right at the entrance to Bryce Canyon, beautiful Bryce Canyon. We would invite the world to come see Bryce Canyon. But when the federal government, over its own political wrangling, shut down the national parks and monuments, family-owned business Ruby's Inn went dark. They lost over $2 million as a family business. They've still had a hard time recovering. And then, Tom, every time we have these discussions in Washington about government shutdown, which seem to happen with greater and greater frequency, people throughout southern Utah particularly wonder if their business is going to go dark, if they're going to stay open. We get these arbitrary federal policies that they have no opportunity for input, that have great sway over their lives and livelihoods. So to a point, certainly there's a benefit, but when you're 50%, 60%, 90% public land in a county, lives and livelihoods, the health of the land, the ability to subsist on the land, to have access to the land, really has a tremendous detrimental impact. I would invite people to talk to the folks on the ground in the counties in Utah and throughout the West. It really is devastating, Tom.
Okay, that's Utah State Representative Ken Ivory. And Ken, thanks much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. I want to go back to Dan Hardinger now. Dan, you've been hearing these arguments pro and con. Your thoughts about what's at stake here going forward. How likely is it, Dan, that in fact the courts would allow President Trump to roll back what President Obama has done in terms of the designation of these national monuments? Nothing like that has ever happened before, right?
That's correct. No president has ever acted to revoke a national monument. And the Antiquities Act, which grants the president the power to establish a national monument, explicitly does not grant the president the power to either revoke or diminish a national monument. And most legal scholars are in agreement that the president doesn't have that power. However, we've seen that President Trump is not afraid of testing his legal authority or writing executive orders that eventually get stopped by the courts. So we're extremely concerned about potential attempts to illegally roll back national monuments. And we'd encourage any Americans, and it sounds like many callers are as concerned as we are, to visit wilderness.org and submit a public comment to the Department of the Interior about this really concerning review and what it could mean.
Okay, I want to go to one more caller. Jeremy's on the line from Maine. Jeremy, thanks for calling On Point Radio. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My family is part of the Penobscot Nation, so we have a real personal connection to the Katahdin Woods and Waters region. My ancestor helped guide Henry Thoreau up the East Branch. His name was Louis Ketchum. But anyways, I want to see the monument stand. I do, because I want to see the waters protected. We have treaties with the state and the federal government that were supposed to protect the Penobscot watershed that have never been honored. So I'd like to see this as a first step in protecting the watershed of the Penobscot River for all people of Maine and the Penobscot Nation.
Well, in fact, Native American Voices are, we haven't heard a lot from them today in this hour, but Dan Hartinger, Native American Voices have been very prominent in this debate, no?
Absolutely. Whether it's the Penobscot Nation and Katahdin Woods and Waters or the five sovereign tribes that joined together for Bears Ears, what they'd like to see is continued protections for their sacred lands and cultural sites, places they considered hallowed ground. Developing Bears Ears and putting a uranium mine in the middle of you know, rock art and cemeteries up there would be akin to bulldozing Gettysburg. These are places that matter to Native Americans today, that matter to U.S. history, and they're more than just the opportunity to drill for oil and gas beneath these lands.
But isn't it true, Dan, that there are Native American groups who feel strongly that they'd like that they maybe don't trust the federal government to protect their lands, and they'd feel more comfortable with more local control?
You know, I think it's really important to point out that the tribal governments themselves are unanimously supportive of this. And as Navajo Nation Council Speaker Lorenzo Bates said, cherry picking a few Navajo people from San Juan County to point to opposition undermines the sovereignty of the Navajo Nation itself.
Okay, that was Dan Hartinger, National Monuments Campaign Manager for the Wilderness Society. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we also heard from Lindsay Downing, who is the owner of Mount Chase Lodge just outside the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you very much for having me, and thanks for hosting the show today.
You bet. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. Or you can also follow us on Twitter, of course, and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.